I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. A riveting book that's overdue is The Making of the October Crisis, Canada's Long Nightmare of Terrorism at the Hands of the FLQ. It talks about what's happened in the run-up to October 1970 that saw the kidnappings of British diplomat James Cross and Quebec Cabinet Minister Pierre Laporte. From 1963 to 1970, there were hundreds of bombings, dozens of bank robberies, thefts of dynamite and weapons, and six deaths. Then, with the kidnappings of October 1970 and the subsequent invoking of the War Measures Act that not only gripped Quebec but the rest of Canada, Pierre Laporte is strangled to death. It's a turning point in the country, and Mr. Jenisch, who joins me now, weaves a marvelous narrative of the causes of terrorism, the emergence of the FLQ, and what happened after. It's a dark chapter in Canadian history, and Darcy Jenisch illuminates it with gripping storytelling. Darcy Jenisch is a writer who has appeared in Maclean's, The Globe and Mail, The National Post, Toronto Star, The Walrus, and Toronto Life. He has written six previous books, including Epic Wanderer, David Thompson and the Mapping of the Canadian West, and Indian Fall, The Last Great Days of the Plains Cree and Blackfoot Confederacy. He has also written the sports histories of the Montreal Canadiens and the NHL. This book is published by Doubleday. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program in Ajax, Darcy Jenisch. Mr. Jenisch, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So, as I was telling you before we started, such a riveting book and a fascinating one at that. So I've got a lot to talk about, but I guess you begin the book by talking about the Duplessis era, mentioning that, and just how the sense that I got from it, because I've never been to Quebec, and I'm 36 years old, so, you know, I'm coming to this history reading books like yours. It really sort of shows, especially readers outside of the country, just how unique and different Quebec is from the rest of Canada.
Well, it's always been that the other solitude, as we like to say, that famous phrase coined by Hugh McLennan. I mean, it was a very different place in the 1950s. I mean, it advanced economically tremendously under the Duplessis era. I mean, remember, he won four straight majority governments, which is unheard of in today's politics. 1946, 50, 54, and 58. And, what he did was he welcomed a great influx of investment from, Canadian, British, American investors to develop the resource industries and manufacturing industries of Quebec. But at the same time, he really adhered to the traditional Quebec, the church-centered. The churches were responsible for education, social services. They ran the hospitals. And, the pillars of the Duplessis Quebec were, church, faith, church, language, and tradition. Mm-hmm. So culturally, it was still a bit of a backward place, but economically fairly advanced. And that was fine for the generation coming out of, that grew up in the Depression and the World Wars, because right. Suddenly, they had some affluence that they hadn't experienced before. But for this younger generation, that saw the world changing around them, they wanted something different, which really led to what we call the Quiet Revolution.
Yeah, and so that's the 1960s, with the election of Jean Lesage and the Liberal government in 1960.
That's correct. They were elected in June 1960 and very quickly unleashed a program of very rapid change, which was the Quiet Revolution term was actually coined by a Globe and Mail writer.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and then the 60s become rather disquieting with what you write in the book. I mean, I guess one doesn't realize in Canadian history just how violent it is, and the 7.5 years that you write about in this book, some of the most violent and terrifying times in modern Canadian history, at least.
So we've never seen anything like it before or since. It was urban terrorism, not unlike what we see in parts of the world today. And it came in waves. Spring of 1963, winter of 64, spring, summer of 65, again in 66, and then from sort of July 68 right through to July 1970, you had almost nonstop incidents. And when I say terrorism, it was primarily bombings. But it was a mix of bombings, bank robberies. There were armory heists. You know, these guys broke into armories and cleaned out the weapons and ammunition. And that's what most people don't realize today. Everybody has, or a good number of Canadians of all ages, have some notion or some knowledge of the October crisis and the kidnappings of James Cross and Pierre Laporte. Mm-hmm. But very few Canadians know anything about what preceded all of that, which was this 7 years, 7+ years, of urban terrorism. Most of it centered in Montreal.
Yeah, I guess a lot of us think that bad stuff happened in 1970, especially in the fall of 1970, and that's it. But as you say in the book, as you write in the book, I should say, there's a great context into how these people operated. The RIN, was that the main group, right?
Well, the RIN, the Rassemblement pour l'Indépendance Nationale, it was initially a movement to promote independence. And the interesting thing is that the Lesage government was elected in June 1960, and in September 1960, this group of lawyers, intellectuals, academics, come together at a resort in the Laurentians north of Montreal to form this movement to promote independence. And they were in part inspired by events around the world, because in 1960, I forget what the exact number was, but like something like 18 African nations gained independence in the same year. And so the RIN was formed to promote independence, and they finally ran candidates in the 1966 election, so it became a political movement after that. But what's interesting is that they also had a youth wing. And it was out of the youth wing, members of the youth wing formed the FLQ. They were just impatient. They didn't think this was going to, you know, was ever going to lead to independence. So they formed the FLQ, which again was modeled on these independence movements, very often underground revolutionary movements set up to promote independence, you know, in other countries. Yeah. And this is what they model themselves on. So it came out of this this movement. So you have a lot of things coming together, in 1960, is kind of that hinge on which Quebec history swings. You get the Quiet Revolution, you get the RIN, and then out of that comes the FLQ and wave after wave after wave of bombings, bank robberies, murders, and ultimately kidnappings.
Yeah. How did Quebecers feel during this time? I mean, you mentioned that it came in waves, so they weren't really in a constant state of fear, were they?
Well, at first not so, but in the 1968-69 period, there was a lot of anxiety, and I've kind of really just, touched on that lightly in the book by quoting people after some of these bombings. You know, the newspapers would go around and quote people, but for instance, in November 1968, there were 14 bombing incidents in the city of Montreal. Now, that is enough to set an entire populace on edge. And certainly by February 1969, they continued in the new year, in January, February, and the most sensational of all the bombings was the bombing of the Montreal Stock Exchange in February 1969. So by that time, I mean, that was definitely a city on edge. People were nervous. As I quoted some of these office workers in downtown Montreal saying that every time you saw a suspicious package, you shied away from it, you called the police. And in fact, the fellow that was really my entree or portal into the book, Robert Côté, who was head of the Montreal Bomb Squad in the 60s, he says they were constantly responding to false alarms. I mean, people would see a bag, just see something left on the street, they'd think bomb, boom, call the police, bang. Bob Côté and his men, go hightailing it through the streets with, sirens wailing and lights flashing. So there was definitely a city on edge, in those, particularly in 68, 69.
Yeah. And so you mentioned Cote. How did you get to know him?
Well, it was sort of the whole start of the book. I wrote a story for Legion magazine in their October 2010 issue, which was the 40th anniversary of the October crisis. And it was one of those things where I pitched an idea to an editor. I just said, hey, the 40th anniversary is coming up. You should look at this. And so he, you know, I got the go-ahead. And so I phoned a couple of people I know in Montreal in the news business. And the second guy says, oh, you got to talk to Robert Cote. He knows everything. You know, he was head of the Montreal bomb squad. So I phoned the guy. And he's a very gregarious, you know, outgoing individual. And, I mean, in our first conversation, he's telling me about all these bombings, you know.
Yeah.
April 20th, 1963, you know, this bombing outside the Canadian Army Recruiting Center in downtown Montreal, this 65-year-old night watchman gets killed. You know, he was there on May 5th, 1966 at it was a midday, noon hour bombing of the La Grenade Shoe Company in East End, Montreal. You know, a 64-year-old secretary dies and three other people. So he was just racing out to this stuff all the time. In fact, he was involved in the law enforcement side of the story from the spring of 63 until December 3rd, 1970, which was the day that the Cross kidnappers surrendered to police. So he had a unique perspective on this entire thing. And furthermore, he's very, you know, he had his own documents, his own police reports and all this stuff.
Right.
And then, so that was how I got into it. And he introduced me to other former officers. Some of them, as you've seen in the book, had kept these transcripts of confessions of these bombers the night they were arrested. And see, the other interesting thing is, about the whole story, is that nobody ever told the law enforcement side of the story. And you see, the story's been ignored in English Canada. The only thing that anybody in English Canada is interested in is the War Measures Act, the arrest of the, you know, 490-odd people,
right,
and whether, you know, Trudeau was right or wrong to impose the War Measures Act, whether it was right or wrong to violate the civil rights of these people. Those are the only questions that people are interested in English Canada. In Quebec, on the other hand, there's been an enormous amount written. But it's mainly by what I say is ardent nationalists, committed separatists, or former terrorists.
Yeah.
And they spin these narratives that are aimed to convince, you know, Quebecers that the federal government used the October crisis to crush the independence movement. And they've spun these tales or narratives that are completely false. And really to drive a wedge between Quebecers and the rest of Canada. So this is sort of, you know, now this is why I felt it was important to tell the whole story, so that when you finally get to October 1970, you realize something had to be done to stop this stuff.
Right. So you mentioned these transcripts and these police reports that you saw. Was that some of the more exciting parts of your research for the book?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, I was just doing interviews with these guys, and, you know, at the end of the interview, I'd say, do you happen to have any documents? And they say, oh, I think I got something in the bedroom or down in the basement. They'd come up, and here's this unbelievable document. I mean, you know, to hear the words of these bombers the night they're arrested, I mean, and explaining how they did things. You know, I mean, it's incredible. I mean, like, the one guy, George Dubray, who was, you know, he was never arrested. He turned himself in the May of 1972, which was almost 3 years after they had stopped the bombings.
Yeah.
And, you know, his stuff, you read his stuff, and, you know, he was, at the time, he was just a caretaker in an apartment building, living there with his wife, and they were storing all his dynamite, you know. For a while he had it in, you know, apartment buildings that have lockers down in the basement where you could store some of your goods if you couldn't fit in the apartment. Well, he was storing dynamite in there. And then he realized, well, that's kind of dangerous, so he takes it up and stores it underneath his deck on the roof of his apartment building. And then he says, well, I've made one of my bombs at the kitchen table, you know.
Yeah.
You read this stuff, and it's priceless. I mean, it's kind of gold if you're a researcher and you get this sort of stuff. Or you know, the most prolific of all the bombers was Pierre-Paul Geoffroy. And he was a guy who was arrested March 3rd, 69, and implicated in 31 bombings. He's charged with 124 offenses, or four offenses per bomb, per incident. Pleads guilty to the whole lot, gets 124 life sentences, which is the harshest penalty, or prison sentence ever handed out in the British Commonwealth.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he talks about, again, making these bombs at his apartment, and then, you know, riding downtown in a subway with his bombs. You know, it's, I mean, it's unbelievable, you know, unbelievable stuff that when you get it right from the horse's mouth, so to speak, or the, you know, the words right from the terrorist, you know, it's incredible, you know, to think of this stuff is going on. And, you know, there again, nobody ever looked at the law enforcement side of things just to see, you know, how this stuff was done. I mean, to have these guys talk about it in these casual terms is just very startling. At least, you know, when I read this stuff, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah. That's the other thing that struck me as I'm reading your book, not only that stuff, but you know, just why they do the things that they did, these terrorists. Why did the FLQ turn from, say, bombing and bank robberies to kidnapping?
Well, they realized the bombings were ineffective. And you know, I said that at the outset here that there are some interesting parallels between terrorism then and now.
Uh-huh.
You know, you look at Islamic terrorists who will blow themselves up in a marketplace, and you think, what are they thinking? How does that advance your cause? How does that, you know, get you any support? It's the same with these guys. Mm-hmm. You know, their explanation always was, especially early on, the bombers were saying, well, we wanted to wake up the populace. We wanted to arouse them to their status as a oppressed, exploited, and colonized people. And, you know, it makes no sense. I mean, in the mind of a terrorist, maybe it does, but to the mind of anybody else, it doesn't. And so these guys that did the kidnappings decided, you know, recognized at some point that bombings weren't achieving anything. And so they up the ante. And, of course, they borrowed this from South America. You know, there were multiple kidnappings in, I think, Brazil, Argentina, and some of the Central American countries about the same time. And some of those kidnappers had been quite successful in achieving their ends, which was very often the release of fellow terrorists, or they would say call themselves guerrillas, who were locked up. So this is what they wanted to do. So it was a change of direction. But yeah, the bombings just, you know, don't make any sense. And, you know, the other interesting thing about this is there's a lot of interesting sort of subtext or themes in the thing, but the idea that they were going to wake up the populace, you know, their elders, their parents, you know, you had these terrorists came out of the last big generation of big Quebec families, you know, the 8, 10, 12 kids.
Right.
So you had a very large cohort of young men in Montreal at the time, and they saw the ones who get into all of these movements, because remember, there was all kinds of movements out there, you know, whether it was labor-oriented, socialist, Marxist, this, that, and these guys would float from one to the other. But they saw their parents as, you know, especially these blue-collar factory workers and the like, as oppressed and exploited.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of wanted to wake them up. But you see, the thing is, there was poverty in Montreal at the time, and that's all these terrorists saw. But when I was doing my research, I'd be reading that press, and I've read La Presse, like 100 years of La Presse.
Yeah.
I don't mean every single issue, but over 100 years doing hockey research, you know, Montreal Canadiens, the Stanley Cup, and then I'm doing it for this. So I'm reading La Presse in the late 50s and early 60s, and it's an enormous paper. you know, like 100 pages on Wednesday, 110 on Thursday, 120 on Fridays. And it's like 10 pages of, you know, Eaton's has 10 pages of display advertising, and Morgan Brothers and Dupuis Frere, and then 30 or 40 pages of classified advertising. And they're advertising, like, you know, everything for the living room. You know, TVs, hi-fis, Chesterfields, sofas, you know, kit, you know, washer, dryers, fridges and stoves. So there was a relatively affluent class of industrial worker out there in Montreal at the time. So they had no interest in joining a revolution. Why would you give up that?
Yeah.
You know? So the bombings made lots of noise, but they kind of just fell on deaf ears, ironically. I mean, and all they did was frighten the people, and people ended up getting killed.
Right.
So the bombings were futile, just like, you know, going into a marketplace today and blowing yourself up.
Right.
So they changed direction in October 1970. And not only a change of direction, but a really radical escalation of the techniques. And so the authorities, in my mind, rightly decided that they had to do something. First of all, you know, they had to deter FL the sympathizers who were prepared to offer these kidnappers material support. And secondly, that's why they arrested all these people.
Mm-hmm.
And the other reason for imposing the War Measures Act was that thousands of college and university students were preparing to leave their classrooms to demonstrate their support for the kidnappers. And given everything that happened in the 1960s, I mean, we haven't even talked about the street disturbances and riots of the 1960s that took place in Montreal. The authorities had every reason to believe that there would be riots, violence, and chaos in the streets of Montreal. And they had to be sure that that didn't happen when they had these major investigations going on, trying to locate these kidnappers. And it really, I said earlier that the only question that interests somebody in English Canada was whether it was right or wrong to impose the War Measures Act and to violate the civil rights of these people who were detained. And in my opinion, it comes down to a very simple question. Maintaining public order for the many has to take precedence over the civil rights of the few.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you cannot allow a major city be dragged into chaos and anarchy at a time when you have a major international crisis on your hands,
mm-hmm.
because James Cross is a British diplomat.
Mm-hmm.
So the authorities handled the whole thing properly, in my opinion. Now, that's something that a lot of commentators in English Canada will disagree with, and anybody of a nationalist or separatist stripe in Quebec will violently disagree with. But in my opinion, they made the right call.
And Trudeau gets a lot of blame for the War Measures Act, but as you write in the book, it really wasn't his idea, was it? I mean, he had to be, told by the Premier, Bourassa, that this is what was needed, right?
Oh, yeah, Bourassa and Drapeau.
Right.
They were the ones that Trudeau probably never would have resorted to that had they not insisted. And who knows where it would have gone from there, because there's absolutely no question. I mean, some of these students were already leaving their classrooms at some of the University of Quebec at Montreal, which was a hotbed for radicalism.
Uh-huh.
They were definitely ready to vacate and shut down that university, and some of the institutions had to close down briefly just to put a lid on things. When I talk about those street disturbances, I mean, it goes back to, 1962, 63, and almost every year thereafter. You know, what we call the May 2-4 weekend now,
uh-huh.
used to be Victoria Day back in the day, and in Quebec it was La Fête de la Reine, which was the holiday of the Queen,
right.
which is grated on these nerves. So what would happen is, you get these gatherings at Parc Lafontaine or Lafontaine Park, which you're in Vancouver, somewhat equivalent to Stanley Park. I mean, just a big, you know, urban green space on Sherbrooke Street in the East End. And it just happened to be kind of a rallying point for young people on these holiday weekends. And then you'd have these agitators come in. There was one group called the Chevaliers de l'Indépendance, the Knights of Independence. And their leader was a former boxer named Reggie Chartrand, who he had a boxing club for kids. And, you know, their the things they wear, like the kimonos they wear as they get into the ring, they were, his boxers were known as the Chevaliers de l'Indépendance. But he also had a group of street-level agitators that he called his Knights of Independence. So you'd have a bunch of kids, young people, teenagers, and people, kids in their early 20s, milling about doing something in Parc Lafontaine. And Reggie Chartrand and his guys would come along and get everything all stirred up, and suddenly you'd have hundreds of kids, you know, going down west on Sherbrooke Street towards downtown, you know, busting windows and looting. And this happened repeatedly. And then, you know, you had, of course, the famous St. Jean-Baptiste Day riot on June 24th, 1968, the one where Trudeau, stayed on the band, the reviewing stand.
They were trying to get him off there, right?
Yeah, all the other dignitaries left, and Trudeau stayed there because, now, that was one of the worst riots in Montreal history.
Mm-hmm.
But you also had, in 1969, you had the St. Leonard School riot. And this was a thing over language rights. And it was an ugly riot. And then you had the taxi riot in, I think, October 69.
Mm-hmm.
So there had been street demonstrations repeatedly. There were, you know, those three riots within the space of 18 months in Montreal. So the authorities, looking at the situation in October 1970, with thousands of students ready to leave their classrooms to hit the streets, they knew what could come of that, which was, as I say, riots, bloodshed, and chaos in the streets of Montreal. And anybody sitting in a seat of power at that moment would have said, we got to stop this.
Right.
And Trudeau did.
Right. Well, what strikes me as I read your book, Darcy, especially at the near the end of the book, when you talk about a lot of these Felkis and what happened to them, a lot of them showed little remorse. And so as you were looking at their fate, say, in exile, in prison, did a lot of them, or did any of them say change their minds as to the cause that they once supported so fervently?
Well, a couple of them turned their back on the whole idea of terrorism. That was Jacques and Louise Cossette Trudel, who were husband and wife team, who were part of the James Cross kidnapping. And while they were in exile in Cuba, kind of renounced terrorism as a technique, but none of the others, and not all of them, some of them more or less disappeared, you know, into the proverbial woodwork, as we say, once they were back in the country or out of prison. Some of them just, you know, disappeared. But the few that kind of maintained any kind of public profile or expressed their views on the thing, on these incidents afterwards, they definitely expressed no remorse. I mean, Jacques Longteau, who was the leader of the gang that kidnapped James Cross, and who, more than any one individual, was responsible for the whole October crisis, maybe he has so much invested in it that he certainly didn't change his mind. He had no regrets and never expressed any remorse. The two guys who, there were four people involved in the Pierre Laporte kidnapping.
Mm-hmm.
That was Paul Rose, his brother Jacques, Francis Simard, and Bernard Lortie. And Jacques Rose and Bernard Lortie, they disappeared after they got out of jail. Francis Simard wrote a book about it, and he expressed absolutely no regret. You know, he saw a lot worse in prison than what happened to Pierre Laporte. And, you know, that same with Paul Rose. Paul Rose became labor organizer. He was with one of the big labor federations in Quebec. Jacques Langteau went on to a very respectable career as a publisher in Quebec. You know, he had his own company at one point, published a lot of Quebec literature. And these guys actually were fully embraced by the sovereignty movement. I mean, they became, respected members of the movement, well-liked by people in that movement. Now, they were never, of course, probably not by, the Parti, any elected members or cabinet members to the Parti Québécois, but the average sovereigntist supporter had no problem with these guys at all. They just, they embraced them and felt they were just part of that whole movement to advance their cause.
As I said at the beginning of our chat, Darcy, that October crisis, and these years leading up to it, it is important for us to know this history, and that it got pretty violent in Canada. It really did change the country, didn't it?
Well, it did, it certainly, I don't know whether you could say it changed the country. I mean, it certainly left a mark on the country. It certainly led to a debate in the country. It certainly brought separatism to the attention of this part of the country in a way it probably hadn't been otherwise. I mean, this, certainly in the 60s, this was all kind of happening, over there. We didn't have to pay much attention to it. Once this kidnapping happened, we sure did.
Yeah.
Terrorists, it's hard to say that they really changed things, but it's certain that there's no doubt they leave their mark on history, and they become become part of your story, if you like. Obviously, they had to leave behind terrorism, and they had to, embrace the democratic process. And many of the people who were in those, traveling in those circles at the time, even if they weren't, active as bombers or terrorists, but were certainly, would know of them, were in the same, movement, groups, organizations, they all migrated to the legitimate sovereignty movement.
Yeah.
They came out of that, criminal milieu into the mainstream. So they certainly left. They certainly made their impact on Canadian history. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah. And for people listening to this, if they don't know, by 1976, the PQ was elected. René Lévesque becomes premier, and 10 years after the October Crisis, 1980, it's the first referendum on separation.
Yes, and I guess it goes to show that a little bit of patience and perseverance will get you a lot further than bombings and bank robberies.
I so enjoyed this book, Darcy, and I could talk all day with you about it. Are you working on another book now?
Well, taking a bit of a breather, actually. It's an arduous process.
Yeah.
And, I've done it a number of times, so I just take a bit of a breather. You never know what's around the corner, though. You come across a fascinating story, and you just feel compelled. You got to jump into it. And that's kind of what happened here. I met this fellow Bob Côté, and he told me so many things that I didn't know, and you come across something like that, and all of a sudden you're off to the races again.
Indeed. I've enjoyed our chat. Thanks for your time today, Darcy, and continued good luck with the book.
Well, thank you very much, Joe. I appreciate you making time.
The book is called The Making of the October Crisis, Canada's Long Nightmare of Terrorism at the Hands of the FLQ. It's published by Doubleday. Its author, Darcy Jenner, joined me on the line from Ajax, Ontario. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plante.